It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegebright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
The person of school age is age 5 to 20, and this may seem obvious, but I know a lot of schools are confused about this. They think school age is 5 to 18, and after the child turns 18, they don't no longer have an obligation to educate them. That's actually not true. The child no longer has an obligation to come at age 18, but the school continues to have an obligation through age 20. And then if the child is in special education or receiving ESL services, they have it through 21 or 22.
Angela Cholfi from the Legal Aid Justice Center's Just Children program talks about basic education law and the statutes that are very favorable for the rights of students and parents. And during this week's question and answer session, you'll learn about the crucial difference between a dismissal of a lawsuit with prejudice and a dismissal of a lawsuit without prejudice. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 114, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's news you can use. Refund anticipation loans, or RALs, are bank loans secured by the taxpayer's expected refund, loans that last about 7 to 14 days until the actual IRS refund repays the loan. About 7.2 million taxpayers received RALs in the 2009 tax filing season. This year, there will be fewer and more expensive RALs. In April 2010, J.P. Morgan Chase, one of the three largest providers, exited the RAL market. In August 2010, the IRS announced it would stop providing the Debt Indicator, a service that helped tax preparers and banks make RALs by acting as a form of credit check. The Debt Indicator revealed whether a taxpayer's refund would be paid or would be intercepted for government debts. Consumer advocates had strongly urged termination of the Debt Indicator and applauded the IRS's action. Without the Debt Indicator, RAL lending is expected to decline and be much riskier. In October 2010, the Office of Thrift Supervision issued a supervisory directive to MetaBank, effectively prohibiting that bank from making RALs. MetaBank previously had provided Jackson Hewitt with a pay stub RAL in the form of its iAdvance line of credit on a prepaid card, which federal regulators cited as an unfair or deceptive act or practice. Finally, in December 2010, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency issued a directive prohibiting HSBC Bank and Santa Barbara Bank and Trust from offering RALs. As a result of these actions, there were only three small banks making RALs: Republic Bank and Trust, River City Bank, and Ohio Valley Bank, all based in Louisville, Kentucky. These banks have limited capacity and cannot provide the same volume as J.P. Morgan Chase or HSBC. While there will be fewer RALs in this tax season, they will be more expensive. For example, Republic Bank states that it will charge $61.22 for a RAL of $1,500, which translates into an annual percentage rate of 149%. Consumer advocates suggest that taxpayers who are looking for a quick refund cash should consider lower cost or free alternatives. Taxpayers with a bank account can get their tax refund in 8 to 15 days with e-filing and direct deposit. Taxpayers without a bank account also can get a fast refund by e-filing and having their refund deposited to a prepaid card, including any existing payroll or prepaid card that the taxpayer already has. Taxpayers without a bank account also should consider opening an account to receive their refund. There are plenty of options for taxpayers to get quick refunds without paying for a costly RAL. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
It's time for the answer to our weekly quiz called, Is That Legal? Last week, we gave you a legal question and three possible answers, one of which was incorrect. Here's last week's question. Which two things are true about service-connected VA disability benefits? A. The disability must have occurred in or been increased by military service. B. The veteran must apply within 5 years of military discharge. Or C. The disability may be total or partial. The correct answers are A. The disability must have occurred in or been increased by military service. And C. The disability may be total or partial. There is no time limit to apply for either service-connected VA disability benefits or non-service-connected VA disability benefits. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault.
You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. It's time for this week's question and answer. We're here in the studio with this week's questioner. Please tell us your name and where you're from.
My name is Veronica, and I'm from Richmond.
Welcome to the show, Veronica. What question do we have this week?
I have a question concerning purchasing a vehicle. I purchased a vehicle, and well, I wanted to purchase a vehicle in 2009, and I put a $400 deposit down on it, and it had 197,000 miles on it. After carefully speaking to some other mechanics, they would say there was too many miles on it, too many highway miles on it. So I told the guy that I was going to purchase the vehicle from that I no longer was interested in purchasing the vehicle. So he got a little irate, and the police was called, and the police spoke to him and asked him to return my $400, and he said take him to court. So that's what I did. I went to court, and the information that was on my receipt, his address, he had moved down the street. So I had to resubmit another claim, and got in touch with him. We came to court. So long story short, I had to come back in the afternoon, which is at 2 o'clock, and I was late getting there. 5 minutes late, the judge had dismissed it without prejudice, and I wanted to know, is there anything that I could do to get my $400 back?
Well, Veronica, fortunately, the answer is yes, and that's because the judge dismissed the case, quote, without prejudice. And that's really important magic language because it means that you could go ahead and refile the case in the same court where you filed it before. If the judge had dismissed it with prejudice, then it would be over forever and you could never refile. But you can simply go right back to the same court and you can file the same lawsuit all over again because it was dismissed, quote, without prejudice. Now, what you might want to try to do this time is file it in the small claims division of the General District Court rather than the regular division of the General District Court. The fact that you had to come back a second time and had an afternoon hearing at 2 p.m. tells me that you originally filed in the regular division of the General District Court. That's where lawyers are permitted, and you can sue for up to $15,000. There's a small claims division where lawyers are not permitted, where you can sue for up to $5,000, and that would certainly suit your needs. The big difference about small claims division is your first court date is your trial date. There's no rescheduling. There's no additional pleadings. There's no continuances. You show up in court on your first court date and you try the case. You basically say your side, the other side says their side, the judge issues a decision. The key thing, however, for all court proceedings is to be there on time. The court has, as you have experienced, no tolerance whatever for even being 5 minutes late, which is why I always tell folks, be there at least 20 minutes before your scheduled hearing. Is this helpful to you?
Yes, thank you so much.
Okay, you're welcome. Thanks for being on the show. One major theme of education law is that schools have a lot of discretion, and there aren't a lot of statutes that require schools to do things. But some statutes are very favorable for the rights of students and parents. Angela Cholfi from the Legal Aid Justice Center's Just Children program talks about basic education law.
I just want to add that the point about the computers is really important because it's one of the reasons that we actually like to go sometimes and get the records ourselves instead of just submitting a written request, because you have to go and stand there and say, now print out the attendance record, now print out the disciplinary record, now print out, because otherwise they'll just go through the file and they'll decide, well, I know they said the full record, but they don't really want this note from the teacher, and maybe we really do want the note from the teacher, and we want the computer printouts too. One major theme of education law is that schools have a lot of discretion and there aren't a lot of statutes that require schools to do things, but records requesting is one that's actually very favorable to parents. The statute actually says that if a parent shows up unannounced on a regular school day and says, I want to see my child's file, the school has to give them access immediately. And we, however, don't generally advise parents to do that because it doesn't usually go over very well in schools. However, we would advise, you know, if you're going to go directly to the school, to call the school, make an appointment, let them know you're coming, and then, you know, then be prepared to stand in front of the copier for a little while. But that is kind of a helpful area. So Carolyn and her family moved from the county to the city over the summer. We get this question a lot around back to school time. And Carolyn's mom is already behind on the rent. The landlord is threatening eviction. Carolyn's mom asks if she can enroll Carolyn using an aunt's address in Albemarle County so that Carolyn can continue at the county schools where she was going before. So what do you advise? So the answer is Albemarle County may allow Carolyn to enroll, but they can also require her to pay tuition. It's not A, because Carolyn is not a bona fide resident of the county, and really that's the key for enrollment. You have to show that a child is a bona fide resident, which means that they are living in the county not solely for the purpose of attending school there. There are a lot of factors in the residency statute that say a child is deemed to reside in the county based usually on where their parent or guardian lives. And those are not exclusive factors, but schools will often use those to exclude kids who actually are living in the county. If you can show that the child themselves is living in the county, in the jurisdiction where the school is, then they're a bona fide resident, as long as it's not solely for school purposes. It's not C, because the child does not lack a fixed, regular, and adequate nighttime residence. C was referred to the McKinney-Vento Homeless Assistance Act, which is actually the subject of the next question, so I'm going to go ahead and skip to that one. It's very important when parents call about this question, because they'll be tempted to just go ahead and use the aunt's address anyway. It turns out it's a class 4 misdemeanor to knowingly make a false statement about a child's residency in order to enroll or avoid tuition charges, and the school can go against the parents criminally, and they can also go against them for back tuition, so you have to be very careful about that. What I have heard is schools lately, with all of the budget cuts, are becoming much stricter about their residency requirements. So they have a lot of notices that have this in big, bold print and warnings, and they'll quiz parents about why they're in the jurisdiction, or especially kids who are, or families who are living with other families, or who are very transient, or, you know, the schools are really becoming skeptical about whether people are bona fide residents.
We get them in the Charlottesville office. We used to get them a fair amount, actually. And the Charlottesville and Albemarle schools are fairly good. They understand that under Plyler they can't refuse to admit kids based on immigration status. When it comes up is when the kids are not living with their parents. And so they often will try to exclude them based on the residency statute that I talked about earlier, to say, well, they came here just for school. And so, I mean, even if they, like, you know, oh, they came to this country just for school, and so they're not a bona fide resident of Albemarle County because they are not living, they're living here solely for school purposes. We actually were able, we would get maybe 5 or 6 calls every school year, mostly from migrant families, but not always. It also happens with informal kinship arrangements. Just because the statute really pegs residency to where the parent lives, we actually executed an agreement with Albemarle County where they have our forms that allow a parent to sign a power of attorney for educational purposes that says, my child is, you know, living in this jurisdiction not solely for school purposes, and I'm giving authority to this guardian. I'm not giving away legal custody, but I'm giving authority to make educational and medical decisions temporarily, and Albemarle County has been honoring those, and this year we got no questions at all. So that's worked really well, and we've actually made a presentation to the Commission on Youth yesterday to see if we could export that to other counties or change the statute so that kids aren't sort of in this no man's land about going to school, because it is a problem. Alexis was placed in a group home in Charlottesville by the Norfolk County Department of Social Services. She is 18 years old and has exercised her right to stay in foster care until 21. On which of the following bases may the school district exclude her? None of the above. So it's not. They can't exclude her based on residency, and they can't exclude her based on not receiving her records because Alexis is in foster care, and there are special rules that apply to kids in foster care. They're very similar to the rules under the McKinney-Bento Homeless Act. It's just a state statute that we were able to pass back in 2005. It requires immediate enrollment, even if kids don't have all of the records in their the social worker just has to certify that they are free from communicable diseases, and that they're in foster care, and that they are not currently suspended or expelled from any school division. So it's a pretty exciting right. They age out at 18, except that they have, in most jurisdictions, they have the right to independent living services through age 21. There's actually a dispute about whether local social services may or shall offer that option. So far we haven't had occasion to litigate that, but we like to say that they can stay in until 21 if they opt in. The kicker is that if they, you know, you turn 18, you're like, I'm an adult. I'm gonna, you know, I can do anything I want. I don't have to do what the social worker says anymore. I'm done with this whole foster care thing. And then the kids get out in the world and find out it's not really so easy without any help and without any family support. And so they may want to come back in and get access to the services they could get. They only have a 60-day window to opt back in from when they turn 18. So that's something to be aware of. It's not B because the person of school age is age 5 to 20, and this may seem obvious, but I know a lot of schools are confused about this. They think school age is 5 to 18, and after the child turns 18, they no longer have an obligation to educate them. That's actually not true. The child no longer has an obligation to come at age 18, but the school continues to have an obligation through age 20. And then if the child is in special education or receiving ESL services, they have it through 21 or 22. The other thing about the 2005 change, which is also similar to McKinney-Bento, though not quite as strong, is that if everybody is feeling warm and fuzzy and can agree that between the school and the social worker, that it's in the child's best interest to stay in the school of origin, even if they move across jurisdictional lines to another school, then the child can stay. So the legislation is permissive and not mandatory. It permits them to stay in their school of origin if everybody is amenable to that. It's not a mandate like McKinney-Vento is, where the parent really gets the choice. But we're working on that to make that more of a mandate. Not be any fun. All right, so number five. Erin has missed 46 days of school this year so far. Erin says she's been depressed and has given the school a letter from her doctor diagnosing her with major depressive disorder, but she does not have an IEP. She and her mom have to meet with an intake officer next week about the truancy petition. This is her second truancy petition. So you tell her what? See, she should show the note to the intake officer and blame her absences on the school. That is absolutely correct. A truancy in Virginia is actually called, the petition is called a child in need of supervision petition. And the definition of child in need of supervision is actually extremely helpful and worth paying attention to if you ever do a truancy case. So a child in need of supervision is one who is habitually absent without justification. So if a child is suspended or expelled, that would be justification. Sometimes schools don't get that and file truancy petitions when kids are suspended and expelled. And has been offered an adequate opportunity to receive the benefit of any and all educational services and programs that are required to be provided by law and which meet the child's particular education needs. And so what should the school have done instead of filing the truancy petition, or maybe before filing the truancy petition? Send some schoolwork home for her? Well, I don't know. I mean, I think she's required to come to school for compulsory attendance reasons, right? So that's another thing, as we always advise our clients, well, you are required to come to school. But the school got a letter diagnosing her with major depressive disorder. So what should the school have done in response to that letter? Give it to the truancy officer so the truancy would know. What else? Child studies. So they should have actually started to evaluate her, or at least considered whether an evaluation was in order. And so since they didn't do that, and they're required by law under Individuals with Disabilities Education Act to find kids who have suspected disabilities, identify them, and evaluate them, then they are not, the child is not benefiting from all the educational services and programs required by law to be provided. And so probably does not actually meet the definition of child in need of supervision. And it's important to note, it's not A, because kids can get detention for truancy. They can get that. The statute is written so that it's supposed to be a system of graduated consequences, so that's the last resort. But the practice in some jurisdictions is simply to tell the kids to, you know, once they're found to be a child in need of supervision, the order is, we're going to come back for disposition in another couple of months, and meanwhile, I want you to go to school every day, all day, not miss any homework, not miss any classes. And then if you do, guess what? You have a contempt violation, and that carries 10 days of detention. And so there are some judges that will actually use detention as the first resort in those instances. So the reason it can't isn't D. So a child has an opportunity when it's a misdemeanor or a first-time truancy petition to be diverted, so that the court will treat the case informally, do a truancy plan for 90 days to see if the child's attendance improves before actually filing the petition going to court. But this was her second truancy petition, so she wasn't eligible for that. Another important thing about the definition is that you can't be a child in need of supervision unless the school can show through documentation that it's complied with 22.1-258. And 22.1-258, I have to admit, is pretty onerous, actually. It requires phone calls home, it requires making direct contact with parents, and it requires a conference, I think within 10 days of the sixth absence or something like that. So an actual conference where they're supposed to invite other service providers from the community if that's necessary. And a lot of times you'll find that schools have not documented compliance with this before they file the truancy petition. They simply just look at the number of the days that the kids missed and then file the petition.
Keep on walking, keep on the talking, marching up to freedom land.
This week, we introduced a new segment called Strange But True Laws from the Code of Virginia. This week's Strange But True Law is from Title I, which deals with general provisions under which Code of Virginia Section 1-511 makes English the official language of the Commonwealth. Moreover, under this code section, no state agency or local government shall be required to provide, and no state agency or local government shall be prohibited from providing, any documents, including information, literature, or other written materials in any language other than English. So if you need to take your driving test in Spanish, state law allows but does not require that it be given in Spanish. Fortunately, under federal law, all persons, regardless of their language, must have meaningful access to government services. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Doris Causey, and that's this week's Strange But True Law.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio show ever broadcast is now available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. In these days of tightening credit, protecting your credit report is more important now than ever. Join us next Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. when our guest, consumer protection attorney Jason Crumbine, explains who keeps credit reports, who gets to look at them, and how to protect your credit report using the protections of the Fair Credit Reporting Act in a rebroadcast of a show originally heard on September 9, 2009. That's law for the rest of us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.